So the scallop, you say, Ken?
Yeah, I got nothing. I think we should just flip this over the interview because it's going to be much better than what we're doing right now.
We'll do a hard cut
here.
The New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, featuring your hosts, Gabe Reinick and Ken Holyoke.
Welcome back to the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. I'm Gabe Reinick in Fredericton, New Brunswick, and I'm joined, as I am just about every fortnight, by Ken Holyoke, who appears to be in... Is he in the... I think Ken is in a coffee house in the East Village in New York, and he's wearing a beret, and the room is filled with smoke. Somebody who looks a little bit like Bob Dylan just walked by, and Ken appears to be in a sheepskin jacket and wearing a beret. And Ken, how are you? But I understand there's some poetry you'd like to share with us.
Oh, yeah. Well, yes, I just got back from the Poetry Slam at the Plains Archaeology Conference last week. Yeah, and and so I'd like to share a little bit about... a little bit of New Brunswick archaeology in poem form.
And listener, I'd let you know that I would play along with this, but it's a very difficult poem for me emotionally, and plus the chords are difficult.
So for those of you who don't know me, I grew up in the Maritimes. We're a jolly bunch, but no, we don't all do the rhymes. Now, I won't bore you with my alma maters. They're in the eastern half, close to tidal waters. A good thing to know before we go, before the Uleth carpet unfurled, I did a stint in summer and winter in the CRM assessment world. Now, in this western prairie land, I figured a gig to take a stand. With a colleague and friend, we picked up a mic and to public we'd speak, archaeology they like. We started with culture historical facts, describing, no visuals, sites and artifact. We've mic'd up at conferences, pubs in our homes, and filling a knowledge gap most hadn't known. You might start to wonder, but our message is landing? Well, I'd wonder too if the prizes they weren't landing. And listeners by the thousands and episodes and dozens, we are finding new publics, not just distant cousins. And feedback from people who troweled never once seem to suggest they're fully ensconced. So let's take a trip off to the Dawn Land, where Wabanaki have lived from the hills to the sand. Since the retreat of the glaciers their ancestors dwelt, their record of ages indelibly felt. Through the millennial histories we get to uncover, so follow me now, and we can discover. An archaeological record to Paleo-Indian times, Clovis-like fluted, then lancelet kinds. Heavy groundstone tools characterize the archaic, with notched and with stem points, it's how they made it. Then on comes the woodland, the maritime kind, with shellfish and pottery and canoes refined, culminating not in a maize village scene, despite that boat captains and complexity there'd been. So off to the lake to understand all these changes, we've got acid soils, so the material ranges, from stone to clay pots and very few bones, yet still our understanding of the past we have honed. And using these lithic data from quarries, I've been able to tell some interesting new stories, enhanced by the chert and its color categories. Two sources for stone, one lakeside, one hill, look near identical, tools even still. It's unclear the relationship between them, you see, but one might come later, the other early. See, the water in Washtamoak was still quite high when the Paleo-Indian folks had stopped by. It's no smoking gun, but if there ever was, a few paleo points made on the chert makes a buzz. Now, when you've got two rocks that look just the same, legend would have it, laser's the game. Just point and shoot, the answers will come, but a PCA biplot can make you feel dumb. Especially when there's elemental discordance. There's uranium here, which is an affordance, and strontium there, pardon my ignorance, but I think we might have some hints for our sourcing. Now back to the talk about chert and those stories of Wabanaki people making place at those quarries by circulating around those beautiful stones and bringing them to neighbors and into their home. The relationship between people, the stone, and the land, made and was made by, they go hand in hand. Increasingly, Bellier's is not just a quarry, with shatter and debitage in all of its glory, but a diffuse taskgate, millennial palimpsest of Wabanaki relations, if you get the Ingold gist. Now the problem I've seen in the last few years is these sites keep appearing, realizing all of our fear. Of burning libraries, as Dr. Betts said, threats to the indigenous pasts are widespread. At two islands on Wollastoog from this past season, erosion abounds, climate change is the reason. So developing plans and mitigating these threats is where I'll be directing my archaeological asset. And while we tackle erosion, extant collections remain out of reach to communities, a colonial stain. The Bailey collection is remarkably unique, with artifacts indicating fishing techniques and oversized ground stone, trade points, and rock art. The purpose of this work is to make a new start. Whether capacity building through archival training, or paddling Wollastoog, or surveys while raining, or meeting landowners with elaborate collections, working together is not done in sections. We're handing the keys over to the whole process, and seeing if we can do an archaeology of redress. So this last part, though, probably won't make a whole lot of sense, because there's a picture of me and Bob Daw pointing at something, but I'll say it anyway.
Oh, good. Yeah, yeah. So that'll make it totally different from the rest of the poem, which I can't tell if it's the best of Robert W. Sivers or the worst of Stan Rogers, but just keep going.
So while I'm from the East, I'm now in the West, and what better way to take in the best field school in the country with my dear colleagues and learn how to point at the probably 10,000-year-old surface. But despite what they tell you the rest of the week, you're not in South Lethbridge, you're in the East. And the joke there is that the paper was called There's No East in Alberta, But There Is an Easterner.
And that's right, listener, you can tell it's a good joke because Ken had to explain it, and that is our East Coast boy crying from the oil fields of Alberta. So let's have a round of applause for Ken Holyoake, and let's pour one out for the boys in Fort McMurtry. And so we are, Ken, we're sponsored, as we are, every fortnight by the Association of Professional Archaeologists of New Brunswick, and they don't have a website, and I'm going to guess your poetry agency doesn't either. And we're also sponsored by the ULEF Cirque Exchange Grant, and we thank them very much. And so, Ken, even as you've been on these poetical meanderings and you've been meeting other hipsters and jazz musicians and people who sell left-handed cigarettes and all these sorts of things, none of them have approached you and had a new name for this podcast, have they?
They have not. No, I handed a lot of stickers last week, but all I got was, what's the name of it? And I pointed out the name on the stickers, and they said, oh, okay.
And so what is the name of it, Ken?
The name is the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
And how many words is that, Ken?
The New Brunswick.
No, it's all one word.
New Brunswick Archaeology.
And so, Ken, if the... We're completely so the listener can't tell, but now that Ken has become a poet, he's become much more flighty about these things, and it's the more artist mentality. He used to be a zapper, and when he was a zapper, everything was really dialed in. But now that he's doing poetry and other these sort of humanistic impulses, he's become totally unavailable, essentially for just moving the podcast along. But Ken, let's try this again, and let's say what is the name of this podcast?
It's the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast.
That's right. And Ken, if they were to find us online, where would they find us?
NewBrunswickArchaeology.com. And if they were going to email, it'd be at NewBrunswickArchaeology@gmail.com. And New Brunswick Archaeology spelled all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY.
That's right, Ken. And how do we feel about that name?
I think we quite like it. I mean, we're always open to change, though.
As you know, Ken, we're still the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, and one of the things that we're going to show in this upcoming episode is that we've actually expanded a bit beyond New Brunswick Archaeology. You actually just showed this a minute ago, talking about the plains.
Yes. Well, I wasn't talking about the plains. I was talking about the East Coast, but on the plains.
But you're talking about you on the plains.
Yes.
This is the classic East Coast story, right?
It is. Yep.
Yeah, exactly. And many listeners and many members of the just sort of general public may think that we're mostly moving beyond the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast, mostly for our food and culture offerings, yep, which are, of course, expansive, as are we increasingly as we indulge in the food offerings. But on episodes today, we're not even going to discuss New Brunswick, real. New Brunswick is a secondary concern to our upcoming interview.
That's right. In fact, the time period we're talking about, New Brunswick isn't even New Brunswick. New Brunswick was Nova Scotia.
Yeah, exactly. New Brunswick was Nova Scotia might be the winning name. I think that was also, that was the late premier's PR campaign for the province, wasn't it?
Yeah, I don't know.
We've just given away what evening we've done this on. And so we've been wondering if it's possible that it's time for us to rename this podcast to just better express what we're all about here. And so, Ken, I don't know about where you are, but there's a crisp in the air here in New Brunswick. The leaves are falling, and the excitement is palpable among the anthropology undergraduates, who are each special in their own way. But one thing they all have in common is that they're all very excited by Halloween. Many of them even have, skull tattoos. It's a spooky season is big among the anthropology students here. Is that true at Lethbridge as well?
I think so. I mean, I've seen some posters up about Halloween. I haven't seen students indulging the spooky season, but we're not quite there yet. It did snow today, so they were looking a little sad and less excited. So
it snowed?
Yes.
Oh wow. Well, so Ken, would you like to regale us with a few more moments of verse about how much you like the Plains? So that's right, Ken. It's spooky season here. And okay, listener, I'm just gonna check with Emmanuel here in the control booth. And Emmanuel, if we could insert some spooky sounds here to set the tone for this discussion, that'd be helpful.
Yeah, sure.
So,
I got you.
Mm-hmm, yeah. Like a muhaha.
Ooh, like that.
Would be great.
Okay.
Kind of lean into the muhaha. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Great. Fantastic. Thanks, Emmanuel. Appreciate that. Okay, so now that we've set the mood, Ken, what are you planning on dressing up like this year for Halloween?
I don't have a plan yet, but there's always the fallback to Indiana Jones.
Okay, and so you would just be doing that, you've done couples costumes in the past, am I right?
We have, yeah, but it's more about my kids doing their costumes now.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so do they go trick or treating?
Yes, they do.
Great, but you don't.
Well, I walk them to a driveway, and then they go up the driveway and do the trick or treating themselves.
Interesting, yeah. So I just stay home and drink scotch and hand out candy, which I think is preferable.
We usually do a shift where like they'll do a loop, then I will go, like Carolyn will go out, and then I'll come back out. So it's I hand out candy for part of the night, and then I supervise trick or treating the other part.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So what's the best Halloween costume you've ever worn?
I went as a rocker 1 year. I felt like I did a pretty good job of the costume.
Okay, that's very good. That would have been what, like 95?
No, including children's costumes. Oh, by far the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle that I went as when I was like, I don't know, 6 years old or 8 years old.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah. So Ken, one of the things that I think is interesting about costumes is that despite costumes being costumes, the pageantry is still kind of real, right? And not only is reality inconvenient in many ways, it's actually pretty inflexible. So for instance, I've always found that reality has really limited the range of haunting, scares, spooks, and horrors that I'm able to encounter this All Hallows Eve, you know, like even if you're in a costume, it's just hard to escape the fact that you're still real. Have you felt that before?
It depends how my evening's going.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, listener, you've just learned something about Ken's Halloweens, but, as Ian Sample writes in The Guardian, quote, "It's hard to imagine humans spending their lives in virtual reality when the experience amounts to waving your arms about in the middle of the lounge with a device the size of a house brick strapped to your face." End quote. But before going on to observe, this is nonetheless where philosophers such as David Chalmers suggest humanity's heading. So, as Ken, we're members of the new media, but so we're obviously not ones to shy away from technological innovation. And we know our listeners aren't either, and that's why we have a special Halloween virtual reality experience for the listener who likes archaeology and is the sort of person who, instead of having skeletons in their closet, has them tattooed all over their body. That's right, Ken. The lucky listener will select from any one of these 10 archaeology and historical conservation-themed haunted virtual realities, or what we're calling HVR. That's right, lucky listeners. We partnered with one of the premier HVR masterminds to bring you a selection of HVRs based on some of the spookiest and scariest material from past episodes of what, for the moment, is still called the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast. That's right, listener. You can be in the fall shelters at SUNY Albany. But this time, there's more radiation. And Ken, in some of these, you're the archaeologist. For instance, you can be in a temple with Nazis, and as the temple is crumbling around you, you have a selection of red, nappable stone material laid out on the altar in front of you. The only way you can stop the collapse and try to save your suspiciously beautiful foreign girlfriend, who I think hasn't been entirely honest with you about some things, is to pick the piece that is Norman Skulchert, and definitely not Munsungen that looks just like Norman Skulchert. Or Ken, you can be navigating your canoe through cold, choppy waters on the quest for swordfish, when what should come up through the bottom of your canoe but a swordfish, and it's up to you to get your crew back to safety. Or for a slower experience, you could be a clam 1,500 years ago, peacefully minding your own business in front of the weir site when... Uh-oh. Wait, what's this? Ah! Or Ken, you could be a soldier at Fortress Louisbourg. And there you are, you're just at Fortress Louisbourg trying to sleep off a bad case of syphilis and hepatitis A when... What's that? Cannon fire? Oh no, we're under siege. If you want something a little more cerebral but equally depressing, you can journey with the HVR to a time when you're an Icelandic hunter who's just killed the last great orc. You're going to have to grapple with that knowledge, knowing that it's the kind of emotional torment that will inspire some very strange folk music a century later. Or this HVR can take you to St. Croix for Halloween, 1604. It's cold, you're speaking French, you haven't had a vegetable in weeks, and you're having gum pain like you've never experienced before.
Many of these require losing almost all of your teeth, basically.
Well, the Lethbridge has a lot of dentists.
It does,
does it not?
Yes. Yeah.
Well, we can maybe work out some kind of a co-sponsorship.
There we go.
We can loop back to that. Or alternatively, it can be 12,000 BP, and you're on vacation camping near Munsong in the lake, and you realize, what's this? Could it be? Four legs? Antlers? Oh no, I'm a caribou. Or you can be an intrepid young archaeologist on the run from three heavily armed and well-lubricated duck hunters at Washamuck Lake. Or,
you can be on the floor of Canadian Parliament, and there you have to try to haul that giant canoe, too?
The chestnut canoe is built into all the virtual realities. It's come standard, in fact. You could be on the floor of Canadian Parliament arguing for the federal heritage legislation you've wanted all your life, Bill C-23, but then you realize you've forgotten your pants. And Ken, at the end of this all, the lucky listener is going to get a video rendering of their experience to remember this all by, narrated by David Attenborough, with vocal stylings by our own Emmanuel Ackle. Just the thing to watch for spooky season to come while sipping a nice warm glass of pumpkin spice flip. So Ken, where would the lucky listener send in their ghoulishly clever, their hauntingly memorable, and their devilishly insightful new names
for
this podcast?
Well, they could slip on their Viz screens and use their eyes to blink out Morse code, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com. That's New Brunswick Archaeology, all one word. Archaeology spelled ARCHAEOLOGY, newbrunswickarchaeology@gmail.com.
That's right. And Ken, just while we're on the topic of that email address,
what is in the inbox? Indeed. So we've got some reminders for me to send out some mail, but I can assure you that actually tomorrow is mail day. So I'll be sending out another pack of cards to people in the mail. So you'll check your mailboxes in the next week or two. I don't know how long it usually takes to get out there, but it is on the way.
And we have a new batch of stickers, Ken. Is that right?
Yes. Well, so some of you will get the last of the 3-inch old style stickers. Some of you will get a new batch of limited edition off print season 3 stickers. And I'm waiting for the new batch of properly printed S3. But what you want to do with these season 3 stickers that you get that are the off-print ones, these are going to be like those coins that are kind of misstamped. In about 50 years, this season 3 New Brunswick Archaeology podcast sticker is going to be worth like dozens of cents.
If cents even still exist.
Exactly. There'll be a rounding error, and these will be worth at least a dollar each. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
So
it's going to be one of those things that we slip into like Goodwills and they slightly overprice them because they don't know what to do with them.
Exactly. So we have an email from Sabir, and it's from business69seo@gmail.com. So you know it's legit. And it says, hi there. I recently visited your YouTube channel and noticed that your content is great, but your video's SEO score is very low. And I have no idea what that means.
Search engine optimization,
I believe. Yeah. So it has something, there's actually a diagram with all sorts of, it points to a whole bunch of different things that we're not doing properly. Anyway, I think it's just somebody, he followed up with an email a couple days later that said, are you there?
And did you write back and say, no, are you?
So we're continuing to get a nice pile of spam, but we do have a real email from Wally. It says, hi, Ken and Gabe.
Oh, good.
I'm haphazardly catching up on some of the episodes I've missed during a busy summer. Congrats on starting season 3. As of this email...
Thank you, Wally.
As of this email, I have 1.5 episodes left until I'm fully caught up. Not sure yet how I missed a discussion of my home state's iconic delicacy, but thank you, Michael, for defending the creamy's honor. we're about a 50% creamy podcast here. That's
I think what the crowd wants is a live podcast from Burlington. Yeah. So Ken, my understanding is the next ESAF is wherever someone is willing to have the next ESAF. So I think possibly the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast should have ESAF Burlington sponsored by the New Brunswick Archaeology Podcast and the Vermont Dairy
Lobby. That would be great, because otherwise it's going to end up in Somethingburg, Pennsylvania, basically, is sort of the go-to, isn't it? Like,
it's going to end up in a burg or a brewery before we know
what happens. But thank you, Michael, for defending the Creamy's honor in my absence. Fun fact, here in VT, Vermont, we take our maple creamies so seriously that there are laws governing their syrup content, and there's a link in here to the law. Well, it's loading. I didn't realize.
Oh, wow.
Creamy Confidential, what it takes to create Vermont's treasured summer treat.
Again, I have to confess, Creamy Confidential is not something I would Google image or click on a link to while live on this podcast, but I'm glad you're brave.
It's from a website called 7 Days in Vermont, and I don't think I can skim this fast enough to see where the law is, but I also think your Great Auk episode presents a great opportunity to collaborate with the YouTube channel Tasting History, though I don't know if there are any contemporary birds whose eggs can be reasonably and ethically substituted for auks in Beothic auk egg pudding. On a more archaeological note, your safety episode reminded me that I am somewhat responsible for a certain anonymous company having to write a formal trowel sharpening safety policy last season. The story involves zero injuries, I promise, but nevertheless, there truly is a story behind every single safety regulation on the books. And you're not wrong there. It was also a special delight to hear Arthur give an update on the stratigraphic smoosh that is Site 5.
Sorry, can we pause this for just a second? I feel like Wally keeps writing these paragraphs and leaving off the last sentence.
I think Wally's giving us the rundown of each of the episodes that,
Yeah. But I feel like there's an element of, like, you know, and there I was in a terrible hotel in Vermont shaving with an oversharp trowel.
Yeah, but it's like an annotated bibliography of reviews, which is very efficient, actually.
Yes.
Yeah. It was also a special delight to hear Arthur give an update on the stratigraphic smoosh that is Site 5.06. To my horror, it's been 5 years since I attended field school there in 2019, so I greatly enjoyed hearing about some of the more recent work and interpretation. Well, you don't have to feel bad, Wally. It's been 18 years since my field school, and, or no, was it 18? Yeah, I think 18 years. Yeah, which is feeling like a long time ago. Finally, please do a follow-up on the pedagogy.
But it's 18 and he likes it, as Alice Cooper once said.
Finally, please do follow up on the pedagogy episode teaser. Cheers again to season 3. We did a teaser for pedagogy?
Wally, we'll have you know, this season is all human-environmental interactions.
Do you know what we also promised, but we never delivered on? Was a trailer for season 3.
Oh, I know. Yeah. It's great to hear from you, Wally, and we're glad you're catching up. And we're actually looking forward to seeing you at ESAF, Wally. I understand you'll be there. And we should also say that Wally was pretty instrumental in bringing about the New Brunswick archaeology bibliography.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So congratulations.
So Wally, thank you, Wally. And Wally squared away a lot of our Zotero files
those
work.
Yeah, and the title of Wally's email is Notes from the Time Vortex. So.
Fantastic. Well, thanks, Wally. I'll see you soon.
And so I think that leads us into our interview today.
I think so. So this is, I think, maybe the first interview we've done, Ken, that was from listener request.
It was, yeah. Right? And this is our first great site that is outside of New Brunswick.
Becky Dunham is senior archaeologist for Atlantic Canada with Parks Canada and vice president of the Canadian Archaeological Association. She holds undergraduate degrees from St. Mary's and the University of Saskatchewan and an MA in heritage management from the University of Birmingham. Her publications have appeared in the International Journal of Osteoarchaeology and the Ocean Yearbook Online. Her research interests are in the mitigation of climate change impacts on cultural heritage and in the coastal zone and environmental archaeology. And she's joining us for a great sites episode to talk about the archaeology at Fort Anne National Historic Site in Annapolis Royal, Nova Scotia. So thanks very much for joining us, Becky. This is a topic that our listeners have been requesting. So we're particularly glad to get you on.
Thank you, Becky.
Happy to be here.
Yeah, we're happy to have you. We'll kind of maybe start at the beginning. So Fort Anne's life began as Charles Fort in 1629, remained in service until 1854 with the completion of the Halifax Citadel. Over this massively long use life, what were some of the significant goings-on at Fort Anne? And is there evidence, too, of occupation of the landscape around Fort Anne prior to European arrival?
Definitely the Mi'kmaq have been present in the Annapolis Basin since time immemorial. There are a number of sites in the region. I guess I should go back and just state what the environment looks like. So we have the Annapolis Basin, which feeds into the Bay of Fundy northward. And at the back of the basin, there's a very large river, the Annapolis River, that extends sort of northeastward toward them, really connecting in the distance toward the Minas Basin, and a smaller river extending southward. that flows down and is a well-established and long-established portage, waterway, travel route that the Mi'kmaq have used and the Indigenous people have used for millennia. So you have this sort of juncture of two rivers at the back of this basin, well-known travel routes, and Indigenous sites have been found well up and down both of these waterways. So the Mi'kmaq have been here forever, and the early sort of 17th century records from Samuel Champlain and the Scottish that came to the basin in the 17th century, they talk about their meeting with the Mi'kmaq people coming over and trading, meeting. So the Mi'kmaq presence has always been there. I'll say that first, because I think that's an anchor point when we talk about the landscape prior to the Europeans' arrival.
Yeah. And then sort of as the Europeans are arriving, there's also a fur trade post that's not at the sort of present day site of Fort Anne. Is that correct?
Yes. The first fort was, I think it was 1608. I might get the dates wrong because there's an awful lot of dates. So the 1610s anyway. So
that's okay. We put plus or minus 30 on everything. We do radiocarbon dating style here. So
around 1610, the Port Royal. So there's a habitation set up. And actually when they first arrived in the Neapolis Basin, choosing a new location after, the first year that they set up at St. Croix, they looked at the Fort Anne location initially as the potential place for their habitation, but they thought it was a little too far inland in the basin. So they chose this other location across the basin next to this island called Goat Island, and they set up their habitation there. But they used that plot of land, this Fort Anne, this juncture of the two rivers, for wheat fields. And Champlain mentions it in his voyages and his publications about arriving there, and it seemed like a fairly open landscape. He talked about vines being there, not too many oak trees. So it may have been attractive, not just because it was at the confluence of two rivers and an elevated point that was potentially defensible, but it may have been partially already cleared. So the kind of vegetation history or the potentially cultural environment before the Europeans arrived is something that really hasn't been explored much, and I think that would be pretty interesting to look into. Because of all sorts of fort construction on that point of land and a lot of coastal erosion, I don't know how much intact strata may be present, but, with archaeology, you always hope that there's something left there. And you do stumble across these wonderful areas of preservation that you never think would be there. So I think there is potential down the road, hopefully, to find indication of that earliest strata. And you could do some really interesting sort of paleoenvironmental or environmental studies looking at that and getting a sense of what the landscape was like, because that's always bothered me. It's like, why that location? The Scots were attracted to that location. The French were attracted to that location. There's something unusual about it. The strata isn't so different that it wouldn't be forested, much like the rest of the region. So there has to be something. Something was going on there.
Interesting. And so it has that early sort of beginning as a fort, and then it remains in service until 1854, which is kind of astonishing. Ken and I were talking about that actually before we had you on. Could you tell us a little bit about some of its, how it changed hands in later centuries as well? Has that also been a focus of Parks Canada work there or less so?
That's been a big focus of the archaeological work, is trying to understand not only the sequence, like what could be preserved from the early phases of fortification construction, what was completely obliterated by later activities. Because as the forts built up over time, there's five forts that one was built on top of the other, more or less, and they got increasingly larger and more complex. And then you also have the issue of coastal erosion. That point of land was eroding for a very long time. In fact, I think it was 1688, they were already propping up the shoreline with crib work because the earlier forts were away. Yeah, really early erosion mitigation, I guess. It has been a focal point of trying to figure out where these remnants of the earlier forts or fortifications may be present. And not just the fortifications, it's also the associated domestic structures and churches and other such buildings that either were kind of folded into the larger fort footprints or just were always just sort of on the outskirts of the fort, that we're looking for evidence of that as well, too.
Neat. So it's kind of an opportunity to study the community, not just just a military engagement with the place.
Yeah, I always think that, like, a fort is part of a community. It's a defensive retreat, and until you get something more like a fortress where it sort of engulfs the town itself. But there's always the fort and everything else around it that that's just part of its story. But yeah, so for the history, I was just trying to sum up the history of the fort and over the years. So kind of like over an 81-year period, the French and English were constantly fighting over this parcel of land. And it was sort of the capital of the region for the French and then for the British. So for over this, like within a person's lifetime, say within 81 years, the fort changed hand eight times. There were countless battles and skirmishes. And then five forts were constructed, one on top of the other. All this within like 81 years. So it was busy.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's not even time to change the drapes, you know? Like,
yeah. And so you made kind of an interesting distinction between a fort and a fortress. And basically, like, you know, when you have basically walls sort of surrounding a whole community being a fortress, and a fort itself just sort of being this defensive structure. But we know that, so Fort Anne, if you go visit it today, is reconstructed as kind of as the Vauban style fort, these sort of star-shaped forts that characterize a lot of French forts in the 16th and early 17th centuries. And so how much of what we see today is, and sort of which phase is best represented, or is the reconstruction kind of a palimpsest of the various different elements of the fort itself over that period of like that 81 years, for example?
It's the finale. So what you're seeing when you visit Fort Anne now is the Vauban fortification from 1701, 1702. So that's the last French fort, and it was taken by the British in 1710, and then remained British in British control after 1710, became the capital of Nova Scotia. But so it was a nice big four bastioned earthenwork. That was constructed by an engineer who was well-versed in Vauban-style fortification. Now, Sebastian Vauban, he was the chief military engineer in France. He was brilliant and he was the guy when talking about siege warfare and fortification design. And he adapted principles from Italian fortification design. It wasn't something that he created himself. He just sort of perfected the Italian fortification style that grew out of a change in really ammunition. When you go from bows and arrows and trebuchet to cannon fire, you adapt fortifications to defend against those kind of trajectories. So the Italians established this wonderful principle of crossfire defense, where your bastions aren't meant to fire out, they're meant to fire across to get rid of sort of dead air or dead ground. And what Vauban did was, he just, like I said, he perfected it, and he added all these outer obstacles and barriers to keep attackers further away. And it was about putting your fortifications lower, really sinking them into the landscape so they weren't so easy to hit with cannon fire, and also to establish these big, thick earthen walls that could absorb cannon fire, because the previous earlier stone towers were just smashed apart. So it's about ditches and moats and sort of exterior ravelins and all sorts of exterior works that just keep everyone away. It became very complex. In Europe, there's very, very complex fortification systems. Here, our fortifications are relatively simple by comparison. And what Fort Anne is very simple Vauban style, with four bastions set up to prevent crossfire, in ditching and a few outward ravelins, but not too many outworks. So,
do you both, for just to catch me up, when you say a bastion, what does that mean?
Oh, okay. So a fort, it's you have these outward projecting walls called bastions, and they're connected by curtain walls. And bastions is where you put your cannon, and they're usually angled outward, and they come to like a salient point or a tip. And these bastions overlook a moat or a ditch, and on the other side of the ditch there's this covered way where your soldiers and such can run under protection from a glassy slope, this slope terrain that angles away from the fort. So there's no way that an attacker isn't visible or vulnerable outside the fortress wall. So these cannons on the bastions would fire across each, you know, on cross angles, not really like at the tip of the bastion, but on the sort of flanks of the bastion. So that's.
Yeah. It's kind of cool. So when you're there, the cannons, they're not pointing out at the water, basically, right? They're almost pointing at each other. So if you're standing and looking, you're looking at the person at the next bastion over to you, and the cannons are kind of pointing down over the hill. And so, and at Fort Anne, and I suspect this is probably characteristic of some of the other forts in Atlantic Canada, they were sited in such a way so that they could take advantage of like the local landscape and this kind of fort design. Is that correct?
They aimed to be in good defensible positions, but they weren't always.
And so what would be like a kind of a, like a good defensible position for, a 17th century fort?
High ground, access to water. So you don't want to get isolated. So you need to be able to have lateral support coming in. So I guess you have to think outwardly. So you have your defendable position that you can hold for only so long, because these forts weren't really designed to hold forever. They were to buy time until lateral support could come in from wherever. So you need to have enough water and protection for, say, X number of weeks, maybe maximum. But then you'd want reinforcements coming in from behind. So it was really like a game of chess, what warfare was like at that time period. And yeah, so that's, I think that was the key thing, high ground, water, supplies, and the type of landscape around you that someone could come in from behind, an attacking force, and get them either in the flanks or some other way, by land or sea.
So you mentioned how frequently this fort changed hands. That seems like it might be sort of an indictment of its position not being all that good, or was that something else?
well, it was on the higher ground, but it was also desirable. Like, it was a desirable position to hold for the trade and for control of the region, which is what the colonial powers were trying to do. It was just a big battle for that. And I think it was because the design of the fortification wasn't always great. And a lot of the times that the fortifications changed wasn't always fighting. It was the return of the territory by treaties. So it wasn't. But then someone would come along quite angry and destroy the fortifications if there was sort of a treaty pending, and they would destroy the fort before it could fall back into their enemy hands. So there was a little bit of sort of preemptive destruction.
Yeah,
in that.
And also kind of victims of like proxy wars, basically being fought by the British and French crowns over in Europe, right?
And
we talked a little bit about that in a previous episode. So we'll link in the episode that we talked about, listener, the post-contact, the various wars that were being fought in North America that Fort Anne falls in the context of.
Yeah, because it's even Sebastian Rale's war and those sorts of things even make it up to Fort Anne, I believe, right?
Yeah, there was a lot. It's like part of the reasons why it changed hands so many times in that 81-year period was because of treaties. Negotiations. But yeah, so the first fort, very simple stockade design. The Scots have this pentagonal shaped, they don't really describe it well in the records, and but they just say it's pentagon with many horn works, which are like these outer defenses that I mentioned already. So probably just very, very simple. Then the second fort, the 1640s, it's the first earthenwork construction. It's not about bands, but it's this thing, big square really with bastions. And then they get kind of odd shape for a while. People get a little creative with their fortification design, and they're not applying standard military engineering principles at all. And these don't usually work well. So these forts are the ones that taken. Either they're not completed because they're overly complex and then don't have the manpower, the resources, or time to complete them. Or they're just the crazy design. Like one had been started, and it was sort of the shape of a diamond with a big, called a fer cheval, this sort of horseshoe-shaped redoubt. And it was started by designed by the governor in 1700, 1701, but then a military engineer arrived the following year and, you know, looked at what they had already worked on, which was this horseshoe-shaped redoubt, and said, nope. And sort of put a palisade around that. Well, he created the Vauban-style fortification. And then when he finished that fort, then he took the palisade down and morphed that horseshoe-shaped thing into a proper ravelin.
Interesting. And, very cool. So do you have... are there like historical records of, you mentioned that there's sort of description of the Scottish fort, but do you have actual like drawings of the fort? And in subsequent episodes of fort building, do they reference the previous iteration of the fort, or is it kind of you have to reconstruct this based on descriptions, or do you have sort of a visual layout of what these forts would have looked like over a sequence of time?
From the 1743 one on, we have historic maps that show what the forts looked like. The first Scottish fort, we don't. We just have the description, and it was described in a letter by Richard Guthrie, who was aboard the ship with Sir William Alexander the Younger as they sailed in 1629 into the harbor with the first group of settlers, really the Scottish settlers that arrived there. And he talks about this. How they built this fort very quickly, like within a month or so, with 70 odd people. And so it couldn't be anything more complex than a stockade. You couldn't construct anything that quickly. And it's his description of the fort that's all we have to go on. So it's an account, which is nice, but there's no drawings, there's no plans. And then when the French, through treaty, took over Charles Fort in 1636, I believe the year is. I'm going to really need those like 30 plus or minus here. And it wasn't long after that. They weren't there for just a few years before the land switched back from the Scots to the French. And for a while there, it's really unclear, but the French appears that they may have occupied the Scottish fort before they built their own for a number of years. So there's kind of a blurring of who's using what and when. In the early 1600s anyway. So that first phase, unless what we can find in the ground archaeologically, there's nothing to go on. And there's also that element where the point of land there where we know the 1643 fort was heavily eroding by 1688. So how much is left of the Scots fort that would have been preceded that? So a lot of gray area there.
Yeah, yeah.
But so you mentioned, though, that the archaeological work is particularly important for figuring out some of this stuff. And so could you just tell us about some of the work that Parks has done over the years at Fort Anne? I know it's a hugely significant historical site, both sort of as for the institution of Parks Canada, as well as just as a historic site.
Mm-hmm. Well, so the early years of archaeological work, say in the 1960s or so, really focused on working with restoration projects. So they looked at structural features like the powder magazines or the still standing officers' quarters. And when they worked on those, and they do archaeological work in association with that, and not too much research or exploratory work was done. But then in the late 1980s and into early 1990s, Brigida Wallace Ferguson, she led a number of years of excavations at Fort Anne, and I was a student on those. So it's all very. And
was that because they heard about the vines, so they figured the Norse were there? So it became a Brigida Wallace job? Was that the...
It didn't come up at the time, but it's...
Oh, okay, interesting.
Yeah, no, but that whole series of excavations took place because they were looking for a physical representation of the different phases of occupation, of European occupation at the fort over the years. So they did a ton of historical research. Brenda Dunn, historian with Parks Canada, did a very focused study looking at the overlay. There was some students from the COGS, from the College of Geographic Science at Lawrencetown, that they participated in the study too, and they were doing overlays of historic map, doing some GIS work to try and get a sense of where all these fortifications may have overlapped, that we could find evidence of the different stages that might be preserved. So there was a lot of work led to the excavation. We just didn't go out and sort of hope for the best. And so certain parts, sections were explored. A key area is the Southwest Glacis. So that's sort of at the tip of the point there where the two rivers meet. Like I said, it's heavily eroded over the centuries, but still it's a prominent point. And that while it was in the middle of all the activity, is very built up rather than shaved down, I guess, if that makes sense. So there was hope that we find evidence of the earliest forts there. But we also were looking at later period features. So within the parade square, within the moat, you know, between the bastion walls, or like one of the curtain walls, and the ravelin. So we were looking for, that would be more for late 18th century activity. So we were all over the place, really. The most productive was the Southwest Classy, because we did find that intact strata that we were hoping for, with evidence of stockades. So we found a lot. But one of the most interesting things, I think, that we came across was when we were working on the Lieutenant Governor's property. It was excavations we did actually several years later that's going to spun off Brigida's projects from 1989 to 1992, because it wasn't until 1996 that we were looking here. But we were looking at this large property in one of the back corners of the parade square. And as we were excavating, you just got under the sod and topsoil, and it was just pure beach sand. Everywhere else we've excavated at Jordan, it's clay, you know, silty clay, very typical soils for the environment. But in that corner of the parade, it's just, we went down about 2 meters, and it's just dune sand, loose. Periodic of like stability, truncation, and sort of like a fine sediment deposit and resumption of the dune sand. So when they built this mass, this large structure, they were putting these cellars. This was built about... the French had started this building before the British took over. So about 1710, in that time period, the building was constructed. But they were trying to put cellars in basically a beach. So it was really interesting to see how they had to modify their technique. And I wonder why they would have bothered after a while, but because it would have excellent drainage. But anyway, it was really interesting. And so we don't know the extent of that, you know, super sandy soil, but in the historic records, they talk about having difficulty with sandy soil at Fordan, and the ramparts being unstable because of sandy soil. But you don't really appreciate how sandy that soil is until that excavation, where it was just, like I said, beach, a raised beach. So
interesting. So is the, and so the beach is obviously like a natural, like dune deposit of some kind. And so is this like an old shoreline area, or like up, with the, pardon me?
Oh, yes, it's a raised beach, so I don't know how that sort of connects in with a glacial rebound. The early rebounds, there's a lot of sand deposits or coastal deposits that shot up. But we're looking at about 12 meters above sea level now, or 10 or 12, I'd say, that we're seeing this raised beach deposit. But yeah, it is natural. It's glacial related. So
very cool. Huh.
Definitely something to chase, you know?
Yeah, definitely. That's really neat. And so some of the recent work that's been going on there, so part of the reason we got you on the show was that we had a listener reach out that they had been visiting the fort this past summer, and there was some excavation work going on, or some archaeological work of some kind going on. I know in a previous career, I was actually down, I met with Charles Charles Burke was doing some excavation work there. And so what's the current project going on? And has a lot of this been related to sort of improvements at Fort Anne? Like, is it sort of mitigation related, or are there sort of still research projects going on at the fort itself?
There are a couple things going on. So we're always doing impact mitigation for putting in signage, or putting in, or more recently, like, as foundation for a new monument going in. And even though they're not large-scale excavations, they're highly informative. There are features and sites everywhere. Everywhere that we test at Fordham, we seem to uncover something. So even these small excavations, small projects, are so revealing and give you hints of the distribution and the depth and the type and the condition of the resources that are here and there. And then, of course, with the artifacts being everywhere, then you get a sense of the timelines as well, too. So even these mitigation projects that we do for like impact assessments and such, I enjoy doing them because we always learn something. Sometimes, you know, it makes it more difficult for folks wanting to put in the monuments and the signs because we find everything. And there's often have to take a few tries before we can find a spot that doesn't have intact resources that can't be impacted. But it usually works. It works out in the end. Just takes a little time. around a little bit. And then the other project going on is actually working with partners. So that's not really research. That's impact assessment focused. But there's also research going on more in association with partners like Map Annapolis, who have been working on a lot of GIS-based studies and historical sort of overviews of Fordan. And they have a really good website with all these different themes and subjects. And right now they're working in the Garrison Graveyard. And there's a stabilization project where they're taking all these, looking at really improving the condition of all the gravestones and grave markers. And there's a team there right now, actually working this week with conservators and stonemasons from Parks Canada and myself, that we're working on portions of the graveyard, the gravestones. And then once they're stabilized, then there's a team of volunteers with Map Annapolis who are coming in and cleaning the stones. And they're being shown how to do that by Parks, teams who are showing them how to do it properly without damaging. So there's that project going on too. So we're in a supportive role in that sense, but again, I'm learning something every time we do something here.
Yeah. And for the listener, you'll recognize that Becky's mentioned impact assessment, but this doesn't sound like CRM that we've talked about before. And that's because if you work for Parks Canada, it's the CRM dream. You get to do a combination of cultural resource management, impact assessment, archaeology, but you actually get to do some research stuff on the side. So if you're a student and you're listening to this and you see an opportunity to volunteer or to get a job, summer job working with Parks Canada, this is a highly recommended thing to do. It's fantastic work, and you'll get to do some really interesting stuff too.
Yeah, this past summer, the most recent work was putting just up from the wharf, the Queen's Wharf. They wanted to put a monument in, so I was doing clearance of the footprint of where this monument base was going to go, and that was sort of a larger unit, and came down on just piles of roofing slate, just everywhere, scattered all about. You know, when you carefully expose the layer of slate, we started seeing patterns in there, like areas there was sort of jumbled, and other areas were really tromped down, so you could see a path or sort of a roadway extending through this one section, whereas no activity or no crunching and disturbance in this other section. And then when we moved the slate in the other section, it came down in this kind of odd-looking pile of small bits of mortar and marble chunks and such. It shouldn't make much sense, but it actually looks to me as something I've seen before at working at Lewisburg. It's sort of a working surface. So if someone's building a structure, then if the ground's very clayey and such, you put down, just throw kind of stone down to be a base for your scaffolding or ladder, so you're not sinking into the ground. So what this looks like is an extension of a working surface, and all this roofing slate probably just accumulated there from, you know, working on this building, and there were just broken bits and big chunks left lying around. So we have this footprint of all this construction activity for what would be a nearby building that we did not see in the excavation unit, but it's probably very close by. So it was really interesting. I like artifacts and features that show you activity.
Yeah, like a staging area from the 18th century, basically.
Yeah, and they just left it.
They didn't put down those rubber mats that they put underneath all the staging areas now today. That's
And so you mentioned, I mean, that's some of your interest is finding those activity areas. And so Fordan is Canada's first national historic site. And so, of course, presenting archaeology and historic sites to the public is a big part of what you all do. And so we were wondering if you could tell us a bit about Parks and just your own personal approach to public archaeology, sort of your philosophy of public archaeology.
Yeah, I find that's a tricky question for me, because I can't think of archaeology not being public or how it can't be public. It's inherent. And ever since I started working as an archaeologist, engaging with the public and informing the public about what we're finding, it goes hand in hand. So I think, I don't know, I just find it just is. It doesn't really answer the question, but everything that we do is sort of for Canadians, on behalf of Canadians, or anyone visiting, you know, or interested in the site, not specifically Canadians, but it's just everything we do is for social benefit in one format or another. And we're trying to improve understanding of things. History is written in time periods, there's a lot of biases and interests in different you know, as you go back in time. So it's nice to revisit things that have been looked at in the past from new lenses, and if we can contribute to sort of expand understanding, or more sort of not complete understanding, but just more realistic understanding of past events than we always do. And it's really fun to talk to people when you're out there working, and they usually tell you things that they've experienced. And again, so it's another way of learning about not just this location, but how it may connect other locations and what people find relevant and interesting. So that's talking one-on-one when you're on the dig site, I find is a great way to find out what really connects with people and then what doesn't.
Interesting, yeah. And I guess at Fort Ann, part of that too, part of that process involves that there's been significant restoration of the very visible parts of the site.
Yeah, there's sort of this balance when you have historic places that you need accessibility and authenticity. I don't really like that word much, but you know, you try and preserve the original elements as much as possible without modifying them to whatever people find most attractive at the time period. So I think for the most part, Fort Ann is pretty intact. There have been stabilization efforts needed to, you know, when there's areas of collapse, and I think in the early years, say the 1920s and such, I think they did a lot of tidying up of unstable portions because it must have been a bit of rough looking at the time, and sort of leveling things off. That you see that in most, or a lot of fortifications that have turned into parks from that time period. And it had a very Victorian, or not Victorian, but a very romantic sense of what places should be.
Right.
And smooth contours, you know? So that kind of leveling off. So you kind of see this smooth landscape. And that's, you know, again, like at that time, that's what people wanted to portray or experience. So there's that activity. But for the most part, that's very superficial and not a great modification to the core of the site. And these days we don't do that as much. We try and appreciate the like the relic landscape, the evolved relic landscape of a place, and that roughness and that those bumps and lumps are, I think, more appreciated now than they would be in the past.
Yeah, yeah. It's smoothed out, but it's still very steep, and it's in that like when you go into the trench and the moat around sort of I guess it would be in where the soldiers would have been going. It's so steep that you guys now have this giant robot lawnmower that goes up and down the side of the hill rather than some poor student trying to run a handheld mower going up and down this dangerous hill.
Yeah, that's the spider.
My son was totally fascinated by that last summer. Between the powder keg and the robot mower that made his day. So,
well, that thing is 800 pounds. And it's a remote control led, so it's not a pretty scary thing to see going off on its own. So there's always someone.
Not like a Roomba.
Oh, yeah. And it has these four blade, and it cuts a path like a 4-foot swath. And it can do about up to 40 degree angle before needing to be tethered to something. So okay. It's pretty impressive.
It is pretty impressive, yeah.
Can you two pause for a minute? I just update my Shirk application here.
Yeah. This,
Between that and the Annapolis Brewing Company moving next door, I guess this is really, you know, Fort Ann has it all. It's got
yes,
the sport,
exactly.
It's got archaeology, yeah. It's got the brewery, and it's got this strange device.
Yeah.
I call it luxury digging when I'm there because the soil is beautiful. Aside from the beach sand, it's really easy to excavate. If there's stones and such in the features, that means something because there's no real inclusions or obstructions in the soil at all. So it's very easy to excavate, very easy to see the soil strata. So when you have complex profiles, say for a lot of fortification, modification over time and build up over time, you can see those layers. So that's really nice. And then you have cafes and restaurants like a few steps away. Pretty nice.
It is. It's a beautiful
sounds
spot.
Right.
It is.
Yeah.
You can stay at a nice Victorian house just down the road and go visit the fort in the morning.
Yep.
Yeah.
So Becky, we're also mindful of your time here, but wanted to shift gears just real quickly. And you're also the vice president of the Canadian Archaeology Association.
Yep.
And we wondered if you could sort of tell the listeners a little bit about what the next year has in store for the CAA.
Well, the president will be putting out a letter to the membership in November, I believe, with sort of an update of what the directions are. But I'd say that the priorities for this, the CAA, are essentially reflective in the committees that we have, say, for advocacy, climate change, I forget all the names they're in, the student committee, the working group on Mark Graves and such. So when you look at the committee structure for the organization, I think those are the primary focuses of where the CAA is going or wants to continue focusing our energies and, you know, and priorities.
Cool.
That's excellent.
So I do want to preempt the president's message, so.
Of course, no. We'll look forward to that.
We'll get Katie on here at some point, and maybe after the president's message goes out, we can get her on here. Maybe get both of you on here to talk about what's up and coming. So,
yeah. Unless you'd like, we could help lead the coup here right now.
The next meeting's being held in the Bahamas because we all need a nice sunny place to go to and get warm in the winter. So
yeah. I mean, I was just thinking we have to see the CAA change hands like 8 times in, you know, 80 years. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Becky, and sharing all this information with us and with our listeners about Fort Anne and a bit about how Parks approaches these kind of projects.
Yeah, thanks, Becky. This has been great. Yep.
Yeah, it was nice to talk about it.
Yep. And so we will talk to you soon and really appreciate it. Thanks again.
All right. Thanks so much. It's nice seeing you guys and enjoying all the plaid.
Thanks so much, Becky.
That was great. Thank you.
That's great. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fantastic. All the context and everything like that was excellent. Like that's a... So these episodes, these great sites, we actually can see like a visible spike in listenership for these ones.
Really?
We cover a lot of different topics, but what we found is episodes that feature specifics about archaeology are like, we get people that listen to those that don't normally listen to other episodes, basically. Yeah, so it's really cool. It's pretty like, you know, it's great to see the people that listen to an archaeology podcast are lo and behold interested in archaeology. So,
and the other thing that we do back, so it was called Map Annapolis. I think I'm on their website, but you'd mentioned it. But I wanted to. It's the MAPANNAPOLIS people.
Yeah, they Yeah, they're really great, and they're very interested in the history, and they're very keen even to do, like, in 2019, Boris Heritage, so Sarah Beanlands, went out and did some GPR because they were looking for the early Acadian burial ground area. So again, historic research and sort of GIS work to try and get a sense of where the burial ground would be, and then they went in with the GPR to look for signatures, and so they think they have this definition. So now, of course, when you do remote sensing, you got to do ground truthing. And they're really encouraging about getting things going. There's some like a volunteer program or something to do some ground truthing on the outskirts of the real ground. Because they're looking for the church. Anyway, and then they're switching gears. They're interested in different sort of elements of the fort itself. Not, you know, that right now the focus is the graveyard and improving the condition of that. But all sorts of things. So they're really good partners to work with. They're tied in with COGS, the College of...
Okay, yeah. And was there... So are there any sort of key publications or reports or anything like that that we should cite? Because so what we do with these is we have what the great citations. And so like we have... I'm going to include like the like very elegant Parks Canada pamphlet that kind of gives a very, you know, like a good overview. We'll probably link in the National Historic Site registration, but is there sort of like a monograph or sort of somewhere that you would point someone to for even some of Birgitta's work or the earlier work that was done in the 60s?
Yeah, as you know, we sort of fall into that gray literature category with a lot of the government reports, so we have all sorts of reports, but as far as publications,
like, would there be any of those? Like, I know there was the Parks Canada, there was the series that was like, I can't remember what they're called.
History of Geology or the MRS?
Yeah, yeah, like those sort of the monograph series. Like, was there any of those done on Fort Anne or some of the ones in that area? Because I know some of those are actually, you can find a lot of them online through the back catalog library there.
Yeah, yeah, I go to there sometimes to someone scan some good stuff. other than maybe some work on the stabilization of the powder magazine, I don't know if there would be much more. I can look for that one, though.
Okay, cool.
Thank you.
And another reference might be Naomi Griffiths, if I can find her story. There's a report that she did about the Guthrie letter.
Okay.
And, of course, Map Annapolis has a lot of good information on theirs.
Cool. We'll link them, too.
Quote from Champlain about that point of land. And he said, the whole country is filled with thick forest, as I mentioned above, except a point a league and a half up the river from where they were. That's about 7 kilometers. That's where Fort Anne is, where there are some oaks, although scattering, and many wild vines, which one could easily remove and put the soil under cultivation, notwithstanding it is light and sandy. We almost resolved to build there. So,
very cool.
That's interesting.
Wheatfield. So that was kind of neat.
Yeah.
It is neat. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So the dune field thing there, so you've got like a Paleo-Indian component basically at the back end of Fort Anne somewhere, eh? Is that the...
Well, I mean, what I like to do is I think we should do some GPR in that parade square and get a sense of the extent of that dune.
Yeah.
Because there really is nowhere else that I've seen that we've tested anyway.
Crazy. So yeah, that's really cool.
That down and see where it goes, because yeah, it's there's something about that that's, you know how it tweaks, like, this is interesting.
Yeah, it's definitely unique, and it's that's pretty cool. So, well, this has been awesome. I really appreciate
yeah,
this
it.
This
Thank is so yeah, much.
This is this is the first time too we've had you're the first Parks Canada interview that we've had, which is great.
No,
so this
second. Mallory was on.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, we talked about Fortress Louisbourg last year. That's right. Yeah,
it's all forts.
Yeah. Yeah, yes, that's right. So we'll have to get, who would be a good person to talk to, maybe you, about some of, like, maybe the pre-contact archaeology and parks in Atlantic Canada sometime?
Vinny?
Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that would be fun. Yeah.
New Brunswick, right?
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Yeah, because he's been doing a ton of work in Kujibukwak, basically, eh?
We've been helping with the, an Aldwin Peninsula, a lot of shoreline mitigation. Civilization. Working with the guardians there, Glidige, I think they're called. I think that means not, the term means more protectors, or there's a different name they're using aside from guardians for that position there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We know, so I know Katrina Sock, who's been involved a lot with his work, done a lot of work with Vinny over the last couple of years, so Katrina kind of keeps me in the loop on, when she's out with Vinny, she usually sends a picture of the two of them in the field kind of thing. So, yeah. So, yeah. Okay. Well,
thank
this
you so
is awesome.
Much for coming on, Becky. Really appreciate it.
Yeah.
No, I've been listening to your podcast. I really enjoy it.
Oh, thank you. Well,
thank
and
you.
And I'm learning
yeah.
a lot. My background.
Oh, that's great.
So it's been really educational for me too. So.
Oh, thanks so much.
Thank you. That's great to hear. It's always exciting to hear people that listen that, you know, like, oh, I like Gabe has actually run into a couple people, like random people that are like, oh, like I'm listening to this podcast. So it's neat to meet listeners in the wild. So that's really cool.
Yeah. And I really enjoy, and I can tell because I often listen to it when I'm driving, and if a podcast doesn't grab me when I'm driving, it just doesn't last long. So that's,
Yeah,
we should get you some stickers. And
yeah,
some
just
stickers
say.
For like the parks office out there. So if you could email us like a mailing address, we can get some stickers in the mail for you all.
All right, that'd be fun. I'd like that.
Yeah, and we should get you a copy of the New Brunswick archaeology bibliography. There's lots of Parks Canada references in there as well.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
I'd like that. I'll take it
All right. Well, send us a mailing address, and we'll make sure we get a bunch of swag in the mail and get a book out to you.
Thank you. I'll do that.
Well, so Ken, I think that was a great interview, and I certainly learned a lot. I think it's time for some great citations.
I think it is.
So as the listener might recall, our rules, loosely defined for this, are our great citations are a sort of a replacement for hit pieces, but we do them after our great cites. And what we do is we try to provide them in order for the listener to learn more about what we just talked about. And so we're really grateful because, I was going to say, Becky shared a lot of these.
Yeah, Becky was kind enough to send us some references, many of which are actually available online, and the listeners should be able to find themselves. But we're going to start with the first one is that she has provided us with a 1702 plan, the Plan du Fort du Port-Royal à l'Acadie et Cour de la Rivière du Dauphin, autrement dit le Port-Royal. And this is available.
And the listener should know that is the same fine French accent I once saw Ken try to explain how we should travel on the Montreal Metro.
Exactly.
With. And
the
Metro man just said, it's fine. You can speak English.
So this one is actually a link. We'll have a link in the show notes to one of the French archives with a high-resolution scan of the fort. One of the things that she noted that's actually kind of cool about this one is that you can see the trace of the curved fer à cheval, which is the horseshoe battery, in this particular figure. The second one is an article from 1992 by J.G. Reed and N.E.S. Griffiths called New Evidence on New Scotland, 1629, and that's in the William and Mary Quarterly, issue 40.
Which is a great, great journal, and we should also say that I think Reed is getting a honorary doctorate from UNB this, whatever our version of the fall graduation ceremony
is. Is that the Reed of the Reed and Hornsby book?
That's the very same man, I think.
All right. That's why.
He's, I believe, an extremely prolific scholar of kind of like Atlantic Canada history.
So this is in volume 49, issue 3, pages 492 to 508. And this is a historical review of New Scotland with a focus on the colony, including Scottish Charles Fort, and includes the Guthrie letter, and its significance is explained. And so that's basically some kind of early history.
It's Woody to Arlo, right?
Yes, exactly. Or Woody. I don't know. It might be actually correspondence between the two of them.
Yes. It's got early notes about Alice's restaurant. Yeah.
He wrote, I don't want a pickle. And then Woody wrote back, I just want to ride on my motorcycle.
Exactly. And also make the fort vaguely starchy.
Exactly. So we also have Map Annapolis. And so this is a link to the website that we talked about. They're doing some recent archaeological work. This is this partnership with Parks Canada and Boreas Consulting and the college. And
the listener should absolutely, sorry, can I keep interrupting you? But the listener should absolutely go to this website, even if just to look at the pictures, because the initial picture is pretty extraordinary of the fort. And it'll really kind of catch you up if you, for whatever reason, are listening to this episode backwards. You should have that loaded up when Becky's talking about the fort.
Yeah, really, eh? Or go wind back and go check it out. Because, splash...
Yeah, listen to it
the
twice.
The splash image is this, I'm guessing, a drone-based image of Fort Anne. And based on, looks like it's probably looking west-ish, kind of northwest-ish, maybe. But anyway, it's looking across the fort, and it's a pretty spectacular view. And you can kind of get a sense of what the landscape looks like around it.
Yeah, it's either a drone or a human with a camcorder dangling out of a helicopter.
it's one of those super, super long telescopic selfie cams that were stuck up in the air. Or it's some intrepid Parks Canada employee on an incredibly tall ladder. There's also a site history by Brenda Dunn, who's a retired Parks Canada historian. This is a book, and it's called History of Port Royal, Annapolis Royal, 1605 to 1800. And that book, I'm just going to pull up the page here with the... and that is by Nimbus Publishing, today it's a quiet community of approximately 600 people, but the town of Annapolis Royal was once the center of early European settlement. It was the capital first of Acadia. I think that's supposed to be the first capital of Acadia, then of Nova Scotia. Oh, there's a couple typos in here, and an imperial battleground on the struggle for control of North America. Backed by the Historical Association of Annapolis Royal, Brenda Dunn, former historian at the Fort Anne National Historic Site, has documented the long, dynamic, and unparalleled history of this fascinating place called Annapolis Royal. And we have a link to the Nimbus Publishing page where you can pick that up if you are interested.
And Nimbus publishes a bunch of interesting stuff about kind of regional archaeology, regional
Yeah, yeah. And so, they actually have a section called Atlantic Heritage on their website that you can flip through. And some of these are great historical reviews, but some of them are, I think there are some kind of quasi-archaeological pieces in here too. The next one you're familiar with, Gabe, and it's Deal et al. So Mike Deal, John Campbell, and Bryn Tapper, Archaeology and the Meanderings of the Annapolis River, A View from the Boswell Site.
That's right. And so the listener might recall we did this as a hit piece, I think, when we did Transitional Archaic back in episode one, maybe, Ken?
It would have been season one. It wouldn't have been the first episode, but yeah, it would have been.
Season one.
It came
one,
out
yeah.
in.
Episode one doesn't exist, listen.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
there is no episode
one. We never
speak
of it.
Yeah, yeah. it's like the 13th floor at a good
exactly.
hotel.
And so that is from the Canadian Journal of Archaeology, volume 46, issue one. There's a DOI reference we'll drop in there, but it's also available on Academia through, I'm guessing, probably Mike Deal's page. So if you're interested, be able to pull that one, the PDF of that off the website, and that'll give you an overview of the late and transitional archaic and into the woodland, this stratified site called the Boswell site that's in the further down the Annapolis River, basically, and speaks to the early indigenous occupation of the region, basically.
That's right. And it's also got some other sort of like history of archaeology stuff
yep.
in there.
Yeah. So the next one is pretty cool. It's a two-part book by Bruce W. Fry from 1984, two-volume set called An Appearance of Strength, The Fortification of Louisbourg. So the first volume is
An Appearance of Strength also being the autobiography I'm writing.
Exactly. Yeah. The Appearance of Strength.
Listener,
My Academic Flexes by Gabe Reinick.
I was just nervous, listener, as soon as I made that joke about Appearance of Strength, and Ken just laughed so long he couldn't return to the mic, and I thought that was. Emmanuel, you can cut that out and just have Ken go. Yeah.
You can add loop my scallops line back in there from the intro. So you want some dead air to follow here. For the listener, you're probably most interested in some pictures to go along with the audio, and so seek out Volume 2. These are both available as large PDFs in high resolution from the Parks Canada History website, and so you can click the link there, and you'll get tons of historical photos of Fortress Louisbourg, but also a lot of plan maps and designs of some of these early French forts and what they're based on, basically, which is really cool. So there's some pictures of the old country system of fortification as well. And then
that's great. Yeah, and that's something we talked about a bit in the interview there about the different fort designers and the ways that forts were adapted.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to forget the guy's name.
So listener, you may have noticed we've done a bit of time travel here. We actually did this interview some time ago and are now plugging this in here. But yeah, you know, it was definitely a guy's name, and it referred to a fort design.
Yeah. It's funny because I had put it on the show notes while we were writing the show. And I forgot to add it to the actual show notes. So I don't even have that.
Becky discussed it at length.
Here we go.
So that
Vauban, a Vauban style fort.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Piece here, and there's a lot of great citations tonight, and if these don't all make it into the show notes, listener, we might just put a link to a Google Doc with additional notes, because we are limited by the number of characters that we can put in our show notes. And the last one is, Becky had talked a little bit about this sand deposit that they found while they were doing some excavation that has raised some... there's some kind of dune deposit there, and what it seems like is it might be related to the Daguerre Sea.
What it seems like, what's the line from Dune? If you control the spice, you control
exactly.
the world. Is that?
Yep. Yeah. So they were doing their sandworm dance or striding across the dune there at as they dug those holes at Fort Anne, and so it might be linked to the Daguerre Sea, kind of an interesting early. Inland sea that kind of occupies most of Atlantic Canada. I was saying that this is actually the same Daguerre Sea that would be in the post-glacial world, basically flooding the landscape in southern New Brunswick as well. So that is in a publication by Rudolf Stay and Robert Mott, 1998, Deglaciation of Nova Scotia, Stratigraphy and Chronology of Lake Sediment Cores and Buried Organic Sections from Géographie Physique et Quaternaire, Volume 52, Issue 1, pages 1 to 19. That one might be a little bit dense, but if you're into the post-glacial geology and geomorphology stuff, there you can dip your toes into that.
Ken, I love reading about post-glacial geomorphology in French. Nothing really gives me
Well, the article is in English. It's just in French
okay.
Journal. Yeah.
The journal's French. Okay.
So.
Great. So we'll put together a Google document and link that, I guess, so everyone can get.
Yeah,
get
we'll put as many of these into the show notes, but it might be abbreviated, but what we'll do is kind of give the full annotation maybe in a Google Docs that we can link into the show notes.
Yeah. Perfect. That sounds good. This could be a good use of our website if we really knew how to work the website.
Oh yeah,
better.
That would be. That would actually be a great place. We should actually put the show notes on the website.
Yeah, we should.
Webmaster.
Yeah. Did you hear that, Shirk? So Ken, I really enjoyed this interview we did about Fort Anne, and I learned a lot, and was pretty excited about that. And I've also enjoyed going through those great citations. That's been a bit of a thrill. But I think one of the things that we're supposed to flag too for our Intrepid listeners that on November 16th we have an event coming up.
Oh yeah, we should talk about this. Yes. Yeah. So November 16th.
You're going to be live.
Yeah, I am going to be live. I'm going to be in person.
Yeah, are we going to try to tape the event?
It might be an odd thing to tape.
Okay.
But I think we will get content from the event.
That's great. Okay, cool. So, and what is the event?
So the event is a book launch for the Bibliography of New Brunswick Archaeology, Works to 2022. You might be familiar with it from Season 3, Episode 1? Was that the...
I think so.
And so that
one or two, I can't remember.
So that was the book that Gabe and I did with Trevor Dow. And we have some posters up for those of you in the Fredericton area. You might have seen our handsome faces adorning a poster that originally had a. I was using my Photoshop skills to try to recreate a Star Wars poster, and then.
And I'm in a smoking jacket, which I think is one of my...
And
it's always interesting, listeners. Sometimes, you know, a joke becomes real, and then all of a sudden there's a poster of you in a smoking jacket.
Yeah, well, and so where the circle is on the top right of the poster, there was actually a Death Star at one point, to which Trevor replied, Are we the dark side? And in my mind, what I wanted to do was design a movie-style poster, like the Star Wars movies. But what I've learned is that I am not that good at Photoshop. So there are limitations to what I can mask and reveal through Photoshop. But
and so beginning November 1, I think we're going to have an exhibit up at the Hill again. And that'll be about like crucial publications in New Brunswick archaeology.
Yeah, so that'll be at the Harriet Irving Library at University of New Brunswick Fredericton. And that is going to be in their third floor research commons. Is that correct?
That's right, yeah. So it's like when you come up the steps, there's a sort of glass case to your left.
And in the same venue on Saturday, November 16th, between 4 and probably 5:30 p.m., we are going to be at the Harriet Irving Library in the third floor Research Commons library event space. And we'll be doing, so the event starts at 4 with some greetings. There's going to be a series of talks by Trevor and Gabe and I. And probably also some of the library staff. Is that right? Or no?
We're still figuring out
who all is talking. we'll have some light refreshments afterwards, a meet and greet, and we will...
And Westminster Books will be there selling the bibliography
So there will be books available for those of you who have not had a chance to pick it up. Great Christmas gift. It's small enough that will fit in a stocking and please any one of the kids in your life. They will marvel at the feel of the book.
And also, so Ken, my graduate student, I'd lent my graduate student a copy of my copy of the Port Jolly volume that Matt right. edited, through the Canadian Museum
and
of History.
And the pages fell out?
And you auto press. And People in the Pretty Harbor, I believe it's called. And it's a fine book in many ways. But my graduate student had this sort of look of guilty horror when she came in. She said, is there a way to put a page back into a book? And that's because the Canadian Museum of History Mercury series is a great series, but they use glue that they just didn't boil enough horses for.
Yeah, I don't know what it
so
is.
As a result, the pages don't stay.
But I remember scanning.
This book will not have that problem.
Yeah, I remember scanning pages of that for Adrian Burke at one point, because it was during COVID and nobody could get into their libraries. And it was one of the books that I had taken with me out to New Brunswick. And in the midst of scanning it, the pages, the whole thing just sort of shed its mortal coil and is now a book that is closed and has to be very delicately opened for reading. Yeah,
that's right. Planning for Fjords, but this book will not do that because it's sewn.
It's sewn, yeah. It is a high quality print and a high quality content as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
So come out and meet us. I think we'll probably do a little bit of podcast content. I don't think we don't have a live podcast planned for this visit, but we are we're working on getting back out for another live podcast, which would be lots of fun. We're hoping that pans out. We'll probably aim for like February again, eh?
Yeah, I think so. And I think after the thing at the library, we're going to do cocktails and refreshments at my
yes.
place.
Yeah.
And so people are welcome yep. to that. And if they want a live podcast, we can put them on
exactly.
air.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. We can.
We will plug
the mic. We travel with microphones. And actually, I was asked at the lightning round last week at the Plains by a couple of students if I brought my microphone with me, which actually I guess I should have. And I didn't get any content last week, but I was just soaking it all in and completely forgot.
And so I hear that the Plains, it's basically ESAF with Bison.
Yeah, yeah. The Plains Conference is basically ESAF with Bison. Yep. It's similar demographics,
delicately put,
and like just like content and you know the big difference is they run two concurrent sessions rather than just one big room session, and it's in, I guess Lethbridge is a smaller center but is not Somethingburg northeast. I think most of,
yeah, I mean, I think in many ways Lethbridge is the Shippensburg of Alberta, isn't it?
it is, except that it's an easier drive for a lot of people in the Plains,
an easier drive for a lot of people on the Plains is a heck of a travel recommendation.
So,
are you in Montana? Are you looking for a small Canadian city?
So, but yeah, no, it was lots of fun and very well put on by my colleagues, Sean Buell and Kevin McGue and Bob Daw at the Royal Alberta Museum. It's great to meet a few folks that I hadn't met before. And yeah, it was neat to, it was kind of nice to have a conference in our backyard as well. You know, it's odd going home during a conference. That's,
yeah, I bet.
Yeah. So it's all the fun of the conference, all the pain of waking up, and recognizing you're at home.
I was gonna say it's great going home until you realize you've gotten the wrong door.
Oh no, the door, I had no problem with the door. It's just the mornings seem a little bit earlier. That's it makes being up late at a conference extra tired in the morning. So
do some of the conference attendees when you wake up seem very young and very loud?
No, actually it was a pretty, it's a very fun crew, but not a super.
Oh, I meant your children.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Are you like, listen, kid, you're not wearing a lanyard. Why are you yelling?
Although, my daughter kept stealing my lanyard from me every morning. That she's gladly inherited it now that the conference is over.
Yeah. Oh, good. And they were like, listen, kiddo, unless you're doing a poster.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So,
all right,
November 16th.
Oh, sorry,
listener. I will be in Fredericton. We'll be doing a live book launch, and we welcome you to come out. And you can find the book. Maybe we'll put a link to the book in the show notes as well. Always good to self promote.
Good call. Yep.
And listener, we hope you enjoyed this great sights, and there will be more to come.
That's right. So we hope we see you on November 16th. As Ken said, book launch at 4, cocktails after. And we think it'll be fun. And we also hope you enjoy the book. It's got some useful references in it, yes. We think. And thanks very much to Becky Dunham tonight for the show about, I think this is our first ever listener request show we've done.
And
we're looking forward to talking to you in a fortnight, listener.
We'll talk to you later, listener.
Thank you.